Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, we'll get the latest on efforts by the local Indian American community to help ease the pandemic crisis in India. And we'll hear the story of the late, brilliant Philadelphia jazz pianist Hasan Ibn Ali. His posthumous album has been released decades after it was first recorded. But we begin the show with a discussion about gun control, specifically two measures making their way through Delaware's state legislature. One bill would require a prospective gun owner to undergo training and receive a permit before purchasing a handgun. A four-hour hearing last week drew 350 people, many speaking for and against the measure. The other bill would limit the size of gun magazines to no more than 17 rounds. Both pieces of legislation have been approved by the state Senate and have cleared the state House Judiciary Committee. In addition, there have been efforts to ban assault-style weapons, although those so far have stalled. Still, gun violence was up 52% in Wilmington last year. So is the momentum there to move forward with gun control measures in Delaware? We are joined now by State Attorney General Kathy Jennings. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary, and good morning. And it's an honor to be part of Radio Times.
Oh, well, we're so glad to have you with us, Kathy. You are an advocate for these new gun safety measures for the state of Delaware. Why are they necessary, in your opinion?
It's a good question. So, you know, before legislation is proposed, and certainly before our office advocates for it, we look at what the problem is that we are seeking to solve. And in your opening remarks, you mentioned it, which is that there is rising gun violence in Delaware and, quite frankly, in so many across our country, gun violence that has increased the number of people shot, has increased the number of people killed. And so the thought that we have had for years now, and that thought is even more profound now with the dramatic increase in gun violence in Wilmington, is that we need a law that will directly affect those numbers, that will decrease the number of homicides, suicides, and accidental shootings. Mm.
Let's take a look at some of these measures. The measure which would require handgun buyers to undergo a training course and apply for a permit. Training course first. What might a prospective gun owner take away from a training course?
The training course is really essential because it is a course designed to educate the prospective gun buyer on our laws, on Delaware laws, and it is designed to train that person in the mechanics of how a gun is fired, and most importantly, how to safely store and make sure that that gun isn't taken away where an illegal gun owner can commit a crime with it. And so, you know, all of those measures are important parts of the training component. It also requires that there be a certain number of hours of shooting so that a person feels that they have mastered the mechanics of the operation of a gun.
And why require a permit for handgun owners? Is there evidence that this might reduce gun homicides?
There is direct evidence that a permit being obtained from our Department of Safety and Homeland Security, which encompasses the Delaware State Police, directly reduces gun homicides and suicides in the states that have these laws. And so, for example, in Connecticut, the law has been around for decades. The Johns Hopkins School of Public Health did a study that is now spanning 22 years. And that study has shown that gun homicides in Connecticut have fallen by double digits. Hmm. Gun suicides have fallen by double digits as a result of their permit to purchase law. Conversely, when Missouri, which had a permit to purchase law, repealed its law, gun homicides spiked by almost 47% and gun suicides increased by 24%. And new research from Johns Hopkins suggests that states with licensing laws have 56% fewer mass shootings.
Kathy Jennings, some opponents say that getting a permit takes time, so does training, and they say that people who need to protect themselves can't afford to wait. Might this pose a risk to some would-be gun owners?
It doesn't pose a risk. There is a built-in time period when that training has to occur, but that's a training that doesn't have to occur every time a gun is purchased. A permit would be good under Senate Bill 3 for 180 days. There's no restriction on the number of guns that can be purchased as a result.
A separate bill would ban large magazine clips, magazines that hold more than 17 rounds. So guessing this would lessen the potential for the devastation caused by mass shootings.
That's correct. Large capacity magazines and assault weapons are frequently used in mass shootings, resulting in high rates of fatalities and injuries. Over the past decade, the five deadliest mass shooting incidents in the U.S. involved the use of assault weapons and or large capacity magazines. Restricting the number of rounds that a magazine can fire will of necessity slow that shooter down.
One opponent to this told WHYY's Mark Eichmann that magazine limits would benefit criminals who don't abide by the law. He says by limiting the capacity to defend ourselves, we are going to be outmatched by criminals. What is your reaction to this?
It's just not the case. We absolutely know that mass shooters seek out two things. They seek out large capacity magazines and they seek out assault weapons. And so if we can limit the number of magazines that can be held, you know, with live rounds, I'm not saying that for long. We can limit the number of live rounds in a magazine, then we limit the capacity of that shooter to kill innocent people.
So do these measures in any way, in your opinion, curb Second Amendment rights?
They do not. The Heller decision, which is the foundational decision on Second Amendment in our century, held in particular that reasonable restrictions on gun ownership do not violate the Second Amendment. And we have study after study after study that shows that the banning of high-capacity magazines and the permit to purchase law lowers gun homicides, lowers gun suicides, and lowers the ability of someone to do mass shootings.
We are speaking with Kathy Jennings, Attorney General for the state of Delaware. You also support a ban on assault-style weapons. Tell us about this.
Well, these are weapons of war, quite frankly, Mary, plain and simple. They don't belong in the hands of private citizens. They're weapons of war, and they're designed to do one thing, and that is to kill the maximum number of people in the shortest amount of time.
As Mark Eichmann also reported a few months back, a measure which would ban assault-style weapons was introduced 2 years ago to the legislature. It had been assigned to the Senate Executive Committee and was never released for a vote on the Senate floor. The same happened with both the handgun and magazine bills, which now have moved forward. So, Kathy, do you think the time is ripe for movement on a ban on assault-style weapons in Delaware?
I do. We have had several changes within the legislature, and in our last election, which was 2020, and I believe that the legislators who have been newly elected were elected for many reasons, but one prime reason is that they support an assault weapons ban, they support a ban on high-capacity magazines, and they support permit to purchase.
So back to the handgun and magazine bills, which now go before the full state house. Not asking for a crystal ball regarding the vote, but is it your sense then that support for these measures is there?
Support for these measures is there. And I will say, and I'm quoting from a very good friend of mine, I will say hard things are hard to do, and there will undoubtedly need to be additional discussions and to reach consensus, but that's what the legislature does. And if we're going to get these bills passed by a majority of the legislature, we have to listen to all the concerns and address those. But I absolutely believe that the will is there to pass these measures.
And is Governor Carney on board?
He is on board. He approved of and has publicly stated his approval for a ban on high-capacity magazines, as well as a permit-to-purchase requirement in Delaware.
Okay. We have a question from Beverly, who asks, why limit magazines to 17 rather than 10, which is the standard used in other locations?
Well, the standard varies across the country, and what we have heard from gun owners over and over again is that it is somewhat standard now to have 17 rounds in a magazine. And so we don't want to limit unduly the ability of lawful gun owners to go to target ranges, to engage in competitions. And they have told us in no uncertain terms that those numbers should be in the 17 range.
Yeah, you might not get the other bill passed. I'm assuming there might not be enough support for, magazine limits to 10.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And our high-capacity magazine ban, I believe, as it started years ago, was a lower number. But we believe with this number that we can still make Delaware a safer place and at the same time make sure that gun owners can engage in competitions and target shooting, as I said.
So should both of these bills pass the full legislature and be signed by Governor Carney, guessing legal challenges are likely here, Kathy Jennings?
They are certain, and we will defend them. The Attorney General's office will defend any and all legal challenges because we believe that the data clearly shows that they will be effective in reducing homicides, suicides, and mass shootings.
I've read that you also want the first state to ban guns inside polling places. Why is that?
The right to vote is one of the most sacrosanct rights we have in this country, and we want to make sure that people feel safe to vote. It's as plain and simple as that. And so guns don't belong in polling places for that reason.
All right. Kathy Jennings, Attorney General for the state of Delaware, thanks so much. We'll be reporting on this story as it unfolds, but we appreciate you joining us today on the Regional Roundup.
Thank you, Mary, and thank you for covering this topic.
All right, you're welcome, and take care. Coming up on the Regional Roundup, we'll be speaking to two Indian-American doctors in Philadelphia about the COVID crisis in India and their efforts to help. Ruchika Talwar and Asim Shukla will be with us, and it promises to be a great conversation. Stay with us for more.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. A crisis of almost unimaginable proportion continues to grip much of India, even as the number of new cases of COVID-19 seems to be dropping in major urban areas. It's still close to the 300,000 mark daily across India, a country of nearly 1.5 billion people. And according to the Associated Press, hospitals continue to be hit by a staggering shortage of beds, oxygen, and other medical supplies. In addition, crematoriums are overwhelmed, and hundreds of bodies have been discovered in recent days along the shore of the Ganges River. For many Indian Americans, heartache over the disaster and word of the suffering of loved ones thousands of miles away has been transformed into a call to action. Our next two guests have been deeply involved in an effort called Oxygen for India, which is sending oxygen concentrators to medical facilities across the country. Ruchika Talwar is rising chief resident in urologic surgery at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Ruchika.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And Asim Shukla is a professor of surgery at Penn and a pediatric urologist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get to this massive drive to get oxygen concentrators to India, let's get a sense of what people who live there are experiencing right now at this moment in time. Ruchika, to you first. Tell us about your family. I believe they're in the New Delhi area. How are they faring?
Exactly. They're all in New Delhi. You know, my mom has two sisters who live in the city there, and one entire household came down with COVID. Despite being fully vaccinated. My fiance is also from the New Delhi area, and he actually has lost now five family members, one whole household, and then some other cousins who unfortunately succumbed to COVID at home. And it's just a reflection of how overwhelmed the system is there.
Yeah. Asim Shukla, what are you hearing from family or friends?
Very similar to what you just heard from Ruchika. My parents have just a couple weeks ago arrived back in Philadelphia, but they were there in India. They both experienced COVID. They actually got it, but they fortunately did very well. But my wife's very close family has lost several members. It's just been an incredible tragedy that I think has touched every single Indian American you might know. I don't think there's anyone who doesn't have a story similar to ours.
I can't imagine what it must be like to be thousands of miles away from the people you love at a time like this. Asim, can you put it into words for us?
It's a, you know, it's a feeling of helplessness. You turn on the news, you scroll on your phone, and you see what's happening. And as a physician, as both Ruchika and I are, you just feel like you want to do something. And you know you're talking to so many people who are just doing heroic work over there. Many of my physician colleagues, I'm in close touch with them, talking to them on a daily basis. And, you know, you wish you could be in the halls walking with them. I was supposed to be there actually last week for a different type of some of the work that I do there. But of course, we had to cancel it with all of the problems that are ongoing. And you just feel that, you know, they're persevering, they're endeavoring, and you want to do what you can. And that's what led, you know, to our own effort to do anything you can, because it's utter helplessness otherwise.
Let's talk about the dire need for oxygen in India. In the U.S., during the worst of the crisis, it seems as if the need was for ventilators. Ruchika, why oxygen?
Oxygen is what allows us to effectively treat COVID patients across the wide spectrum of disease, right? So you have patients who might be in critical care units on ventilators. They obviously need oxygen, but you also have the patients who are stable enough to perhaps be discharged to home or be in a lower acuity setting. Those patients are able to stay out of the ICU because of the support of just nasal cannula oxygen, which is like the basic form of supplemental O2. So without that basic supply, it's really hard to even treat patients who otherwise would have done well with their COVID course here in the United States, because we were able to get them out of the hospital and free up the beds.
So tell us about what you were experiencing as this is, you know, what was unfolding in India thousands of miles away, and how you got to be at the forefront of a hugely successful oxygen drive, Ruchika.
Sure. I was home with family now that we're all fully vaccinated and we're able to gather in small groups. I was with my mom, who lives in New Jersey, and we were talking to our family members back home in New Delhi who were faced with these lockdowns. And more importantly, she was talking to her classmates, all of whom went to medical school in New Delhi. And they were so moved by what they were hearing from their colleagues back home that they committed to purchasing a small number of oxygen concentrators to send to Delhi. And I said to her, what can I do to help? How can I be a part of this? By that time, my fiance had several family members who had already passed, and I was just really moved by what was happening. So I simply sent out an email to about 30 colleagues, and I posted a tweet on social media, and it picked up a lot of traction, eventually going viral on you know, making its way to Instagram. And that's how I began this massive fundraising effort. I partnered with a few of her medical school colleagues. Dr. Shubha Varma is really one of the leaders of this Oxygen for India initiative. And we were able to use this outpouring of generosity and funds towards buying large supplies of not just concentrators, but various other needed, much needed supplies like tubing, pulse oximeters, mm-hmm. various other ventilatory supplies like BiPAP machines, et cetera. And more importantly, our reach ended up spreading beyond just Delhi. We ended up reaching out to various other contacts we had. Dr. Shukla can tell us more about his contacts in Ahmedabad, Gujarat, but, you know, we ended up reaching Lucknow, Calcutta, Mumbai. So that's been really a testament to the support and the trust that people have put in us.
Yeah. And Asim, as you referenced earlier, you know, there's a huge amount of support from the Indian American community in this area. No surprise.
Yeah, no, it's
this just mushroomed this effort.
Right, right. It's been so encouraging. And there are, you know, so many organizations that are doing incredible work in this regard. And I think one of the more prominent, I'd just do a shout out, is Seva International, which has been, you know, I think it's hit $10 or $15 million in support in a very short period of time that they've been doing. And, you know, when Aruchika brought me into this project, what we really focused on is that we believe that we could do almost like a boutique project, that we had on the ground contacts in India. Dr. Shubha Varma that she mentioned, and a few of the other doctors that are in our group, that, hey, you know, we actually work with many of these physicians. We have long-standing ties. And we really felt that we could sort of cut through some of that red tape in bureaucracy and get these concentrators into hands and strapped onto patients very quickly and very directly. And that's really been the focus on our group. So, you know, we might not be as high profile, and there are, you know, we have USAID and many large organizations sending, you know, into the thousands. Yeah. But what's really gratified us is that we can put these on the ground, and we've already put something like 300 oxygen concentrators at hospitals where we know they're immediately being put to use. And getting that immediate feedback has been really great about this effort.
We have a question from a listener, Mike, who asks, why is COVID hitting India so hard with so many people dying? Does it have to do with the variants, the health system, pre-existing conditions? Asim, you want to take a crack at that?
I would say a little bit of all of the above. You know, India got past the first wave very well with a very strong lockdown. But that lockdown had consequences, you know, very strong economic consequences. So there was really sort of an overlying thought that this is really not a great option in a country that is already economically challenged as India is. Scientifically, I think it was it was excellent. It was very effective, but the real world consequences were very severe. And, you know, many people are analyzing what happened, how did this second spike occur and so severe. But there are many parts to it. There is, exactly as your caller mentioned, there is a double mutant effect, which is a Indian variant as well as the British variant sort of joining into one double mutant, they're calling it, for lack of a better term. And that is, by all studies, seems to be more infectious. So it's easier to catch it. It doesn't seem necessarily to be more severe, but it may be. There's still more studies going on, but it seemed to affect much more of the population than the first one. And yes, India does have a very extensive public health system, but it's also very patchy. And when you're talking about 1.3 billion people, many people who can't afford private health care and a private health care system that is much smaller and not nearly as versatile as what we have here, you have many of the elements in place to have a pandemic on the pandemic scale that we're now seeing happening and playing out in India. In many ways, it's sort of what we saw in Italy or the UK early on, but it's happening at the scale of a 1.3 billion population, and you can see that happen.
And in addition, there's now concern about a black fungus infection going along with COVID. So even though cases seem to be plateauing in some areas, the urban areas, there's still a lot of concern that this crisis is far from over in India. Ruchika, you helped care for patients in the United States as a physician during the overwhelming early days of the virus in this country, so you know what the worst looks like. You know, now, of course, the U.S. is climbing toward recovery. Vaccines are going unused and unwanted in some areas in this country. There is a critical shortage in India. Are you experiencing kind of a conflict of emotion here? I mean, what do you think of the Biden administration's reaction to the crisis?
I think a conflict is exactly what we're facing. A lot of people here of my generation who are both in and out of healthcare are really optimistic when we look around in the United States and see the progress that we've made, especially with, you know, the Biden administration. I apologize, especially with the CDC recently stating that, you know, they feel safe that vaccinated folks can perhaps in some situations even ditch a mask. And then we look at home and it's just heartbreaking to see what's happening there and to see, you know, a sense of relief here, but a sense of real despair when we talk to our family and friends at home. Yeah. You know, it's a difficult situation. I think vaccine equity is definitely something that needs to be addressed in this situation, but even more so, I would say, globally. And I hope that we can continue to take steps in the right direction to ensure that we can use our, whether it's our vaccines or our raw materials we have access to ensure that people around the world are able to have the same vaccination access that we have here in the United States.
And again, you know, a few weeks ago, the Biden administration pledged to offer millions of doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine to other countries once that vaccine is confirmed to be safe. I think the goal is July. Asim, I've read some Indian American doctors are advising loved ones back home who are affected by COVID. Have you found yourself in that situation? And if so, guessing this is an overnight effort because of the time difference.
Yes, there are several efforts like that. I have very close friends who are doing exactly that, running helplines and call services and dealing all night long with questions, basically with the goal that can we keep patients who don't need to be in the hospital from rushing to hospitals and overwhelming an already overburdened system. So if we can sort of diagnose patients at home, say, okay, your oxygen concentration is X, which is acceptable, don't go to the hospital right now, take these conservative measures and you'll be okay. There are several organizations that I could name that are running helplines like that right now. You know, for our effort that, you know, the oxygen concentrator for India, very much like you mentioned, is now sort of pivoting to can we get amphotericin B to India? You know, if I was to ask
Which
your listeners, how could you support this? Right. That is the drug that would treat the mucormycosis or that black fungus that you just mentioned.
Okay.
I'm speaking to the largest public hospital in Asia. It's a free hospital based in Ahmedabad. I've just got off the phone. They have 3,000 beds. Of those, he said, the superintendent of the hospital just told me the COVID peak has passed. The mucormycosis peak is right now. And he said 500 beds are patients with this black fungus, and they come in with really terrible symptoms that I don't, you know, you wouldn't want to hear on a morning talk show, but it quickly spreads, and there's, a antifungal that is completely out in most places in India. So we're really kind of focusing on how do we get that now into the hands of patients in India. So, you know, our effort continues, and the need is prevalent. And as Ruchika mentioned also, you know, it was New Delhi, and then it spread to Gujarat and Mumbai. Now it's in Goa, and it's heading south. India is really, you know, Europe in one country, right? So you've gotten through the UK and maybe France and Italy, and now it's heading down Eastern Europe. And it's a huge country, and each place is going to have its own peak and its own troughs. And so, you know, we've got a lot of work ahead of us here.
Asim, you've been heavily involved in the logistics of this operation. How do you, to the best of your ability, you know, thousands of miles away, make certain medical supplies get to where they need to go?
That really, you know, I'm going to give credit to Ruchika and our team. You know, this is making sure that every shipment has the proper invoice, has the customs clearance, a letter from the Ministry of Trade saying that this is for donation and not to be sold, a letter from the recipient, the consignee, saying that we will use this only, we will not charge patients to utilize this. It is an entire system. We've got, you know, Ruchika's got a team of Penn medical students that she's working with, and they've been working into the morning and night. But it's really just having a check mark, you know, checklist. Okay, everything is there in order, and then making sure it gets there. And that's what we can, you know, we've been able to do as a smaller team. And some of the larger shipments you might have seen, you know, in different news coverage got held up in different warehouses at different parts, just trying to get the logistics of getting it into the hands of the hospitals. Not a simple thing.
So, Ruchika, we've only got, well, I guess, about a minute left here. What needs to happen next in the effort to help ease the pandemic crisis in India? Where do you see your volunteer efforts going?
I think it's dealing with this new sequela of COVID, as Dr. Shukla just mentioned, getting antifungals to where they need to go. I think it is vaccinations, vaccinations, vaccinations. I think diverting all of international aid to getting both unused vaccines and raw materials for vaccines to India so that people can really ramp up the vaccination rates. That's the way out. That's what helped us. And then I think just, you know, once we have time to sit back and reflect on this, really looking at how we can improve the healthcare infrastructure in India. I mean, as Dr. Shukla mentioned, it exists. They have all the technology available here in the United States, yeah, but it's patchy. So those same access to care issues we face here, they face to a greater degree there because of the increased population.
Now, Ruchika, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us to speak about this critical work you and Asim and so many others are doing. Ruchika Talwar, Rising Chief Resident in Urologic Surgery at Penn, Asim Shukla, Professor of Surgery at Penn, and Pediatric Urologist at CHOP. So great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, stay close.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back. This is the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For the remainder of the hour, we're going to be talking about the discovery of a musical treasure, a recording of the master tapes of an album showcasing the late Philadelphia jazz pianist Hassan Ibn Ali, tapes long thought to have been destroyed by fire. If you haven't heard of Ibn Ali, you're not alone. He was a musician of stunning talent whose early studio sessions in the mid-1960s were meant to be the start of an extraordinary career, but instead marked the beginning and the end of his time as a recording artist. Hassan's life was marred by tragedy. Atlantic Records put the album aside, and the masters were later lost to a storage facility blaze in the late 1970s. Turns out a tape recording of those studio sessions does exist, and the result is a new album, which finally gives Ibn Ali his due. It's called Metaphysics, the Lost Atlantic Album, and Philadelphia Inquirer music critic Dan DeLuca wrote about Hassan Ibn Ali recently, and he's here to tell us more about this extraordinary story. Good to have you with us, Dan.
Great to be here.
And that clip we just heard is, I believe, called Metamorphosis from the album. Let's talk about who Hassan Ibn Ali was as a musician, a jazz pianist. Again, he was said to be brilliant. How so?
Mm-hmm. Well, he's sort of a mysterious figure, you know, a bit of a phantom, and because there isn't, until this was found, there was previously only one recording, one professional recording that was done and released, which was released in 1965. which was called the Max Roach Trio, featuring the legendary Hassan. And that tells you something about just the way he was billed, that sort of those in the know, he was kind of a Philadelphia legend, and if you knew, you knew, if you know what I mean. So he had grown up in Philadelphia, in North Philadelphia. He was born William Henry Lankford Jr., though in the late 40s he would perform as William Langford. He changed the K to a G, played in clubs in North Philly somewhat, but mainly was known for kind of constantly practicing, developing his own concepts, refining his technique, and not necessarily playing that well with others, yeah. You know, or being that interested in advancing his career.
Well, as you report, you said sometimes somebody would be on the stage playing piano, but that might not be for long if Ibn Ali wanted to jump in.
Right, right. And literally pushing people off the bench at times. Lewis Porter, who I talked to, who was one of the producers of this record and is instrumental in finding it, talked about how he spoke with Steve Coon, who was a pianist who played with John Coltrane in New York, and told the story of that happening, of like being like kind of mid-song and feeling a push at his shoulder and realizing it was Hassan pushing him off the bench. So this, you get this idea, image of this brilliant guy whose reputation is rich and powerful enough and respected, yeah, that though he could, behave in a manner that might seem to be rude and obtuse, was forgiven because everyone respected his talent so much.
Yeah. You quote historian Lewis Porter, who points out that in Philadelphia, jazz musicians were into exploring advanced music theory concept, and that Hassan Ibn Ali was right in the middle of that. Let's hear some more of his work. This is called Powell, and again, it's from the Metaphysics, The Lost Atlantic album. Ibn Ali's playing there along with that of other musicians. So again, advanced music theory concepts. How did this exploration color what he did?
Well, he's, a lot of that particular song, the full title is Richard May Love Give Powell, which is sort of an enigmatic title. It's sort of an homage to Bud Powell, who was one of the pianists who was a big influence on him. That song is actually a little bit more sedate and less adventurous and experimental than some of the other tracks on the record. Odine Pope, who is a saxophone player who played with him and knew him very well, and learned from him, practiced with him obsessively, talks about how Hassan had kind of advanced his own concepts of chord progressions that maybe made sense to him. They're often very dense. A lot of his playing is very hectic and energetic and takes a little while to get used to. Very energetic right hand on the high end of the keyboard. There's a whole tradition like people talk about, he played with John Coltrane in the 50s. There are no recordings of that, but a lot of people feel that Coltrane, there was an exchange of ideas there. The whole idea of the sheets of sound that Coltrane developed in, particularly in the record Giant Steps, which was recorded in 1959, that some of those ideas might have been exchanged or developed along with, his connections with Hassan. And then McCoy Tyner, who played with Coltrane and went on to a fabulous career, was also that you could hear some of Hassan's playing in there. And there's actually an interesting quote where McCoy spoke about on the liner notes to a record that he recorded in the 1970s. And this is typical of I'm just looking for this particular quote. It's typical of the reputation that Hassan had, in that he spoke about there being a piano player in Philly who probably may never leave. However, his talents and directions had a great influence on my playing, he said in his 1973 album Extensions, without actually naming him.
The color of his playing colored so many others who were so much better known. Why don't we get to this, the album. So as he mentioned earlier, his debut was on an album, the Max Roach Trio, featuring the legendary Hassan. But then Ibn Ali records his first session as a leader in New York. This album should have been the springboard to life as a rising star, but then his life took a terrible turn. Quickly, what happened there?
What happens is he goes back to Philadelphia and is arrested on narcotics possession charges, and which he had, there's a history of. So that happens in 1966. And basically when the record needs to be mixed, he needs to return to New York to finish, put the, polishing touches on the recording, and he's not available to do it. And he asks Odine Pope, who is the young saxophonist still working today, who was making his recording debut, and I think at age 26, to go back up and finish that for me. And when Atlantic Records learns that their would-be new star is not going to be available to promote the record and tour, they put it on the shelf. But it never released at that time. And then there's some question about whether his life starts to spiral downward immediately, because there are many short stays in prison. He's in Holmesburg Prison at the time. Or if it's just that he never really had any interest in promoting his own career. If you know what I mean, like the idea, he was brought, Max Roach heard him, so Max Roach made this record with him, and then that record came out and people at Atlantic got excited about him, but the direction of his career never really came from him. So
he was a complicated person.
The record never comes out. His life takes another tragic turn. 1972, that he lived with his parents and their house burns down and his mother died. On North Gratz Street in North Philadelphia. And then in 1978, the master tapes are destroyed in a fire in a storage facility in Long Branch, New Jersey, where tapes of Aretha Franklin records and Ornette Coleman albums are also destroyed. So at that point, it's thought to be lost forever.
And at that point, too, Ibn Ali was nearing the end of his life.
Right. So he passes in 1980. So he's gone, and those sessions are sort of forgotten. And then the next thing that happens is, in 2017, Lewis Porter plays a show in Philadelphia at the Clef Club on South Broad Street, and that's to celebrate the 50th year of John Coltrane's death, and gets to talking with all these Philadelphia musicians. Bobby Zankel is the saxophonist who led that band, and Hassan's name comes up again, and Lewis Porter then talks to a guy named Alan Sukernig, who had made recordings of Hassan in the early 60s when Sukernig was a student at the University of Pennsylvania.
So there's a rogue recording of Hassan out there, in other words.
Yes, yes. And so those recordings are made at Hill House, the then women's dormitory at the University of Penn in the early 60s. And Alan has possession of these. And so Lewis and Alan have a conversation and say, oh, you know, maybe we should talk about putting those out someday. And Alan says to Lewis, well, why don't we look for that, see if there's a copy of that tape of the session from 1965 somewhere. And that led to a few phone calls and the search of a storage facility, a Warner Atlantic storage facility in Los Angeles, and lo and behold, tape was there.
Unbelievable. So, yeah. So Dan, this is, and we only have a couple of minutes, unfortunately, but this is a quarter-inch tape mm-hmm. that's been around for decades. Is it nothing right. short of miraculous that the tape of the Metaphysics session or that this music recording actually survived and was able to be restored?
Yeah. And it was, there's a Grammy-winning engineer who worked on it. And if you listen to it, I mean, it's third generation, really, because what happens was from the masters, an acetate is made, and then from the acetate, this backup tape was made on this eroded quarter inch tape. But if you listen to it, unless you're a audiophile with really an acute ear, I don't think you would think that there's any loss there really in the sound.
And as far as Ibn Ali's work is concerned, is it true that jazz legend Thelonious Monk looked up to Ibn Ali?
That is. There's a story about that. Like you know, there are all these. There's a drummer named Donald Duck Bailey, Duck being his nickname, uh-huh. who said in a 2008 interview, "And who was Monk's idol? Hassan Ibn Ali. Nobody knows that." Now, some people would say, was he really his idol? But I think it's clear that he admired him. There's a great story that Alan Sukernig told me that Hassan had told him that there's this the woman that Monk lived with and whose house he died with in North Jersey, and when Hassan went there to play for her, that Monk was in the house and supposedly hid in the closet and listened, which I don't know if that's true or not, or if that's apocryphal, but Monk was kind of a strange guy, and maybe he was like too in awe of Hassan's talent to come out and meet him.
Isn't that something? There's a lot of stories.
So there's a lot of these sort of legendary stories about Hassan, and now we have more music to go with a legend.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds left. So, as a music critic, how would you describe Ibn Ali's work? And B, is he finally on the verge of getting his due as a musician? So about
I think that's right.
Seconds.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's sort of his work is he's kind of a comes in this hard bop jazz tradition, but also was an experimenter, had his own sound, his own as we said before, his own harmonic concepts and ideas that you can. It's the kind of record that you hear the first couple times you hear it might seem like a little naughty and hectic, and then it starts to make sense. Odin Pope talks about that a lot of times he would play at the Woodbine Club in North Philadelphia, and other musicians, the saxophonists, would get off the stage and let him play alone because they couldn't really follow what he did, but it makes sense to them musically while being advanced and ahead of its time. And now here it is 50 years later, and it still feels modern.
Well, listen, Dan DeLuca, pleasure to have you with us. Dan is music critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This song is called Atlantic Ones. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for listening. Be well.